among other things, why I couldn't find anything is because getting an attenuated live vaccine takes a lot more time than a messenger RNA. So I don't think it exists, yet it is part of the approval process for the Food and Drug Administration. So that's that.
Dan.
Sorry, I just got the tail end of that transmission.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
With the same question about donating blood, what if you recently had vaccines for other problems? It could be pneumococcal, it could be liver, it could be for diseases against endometrial problems. Was that also included, or was it just for COVID-19?
My knowledge, the notice from the Food and Drug Administration was purely related to COVID. Now, the Food and Drug Administration might have other suggestions for people who have recently taken attenuated live vaccinations. I am unaware of them. Most vaccines these days tend to not be live attenuated. Certainly the latest and greatest, the messenger RNA and the adenovirus are not related to a live virus vaccine. But it'll be interesting. I'll have to take a look to see if the FDA has any kind of notices. I don't think there's a large incidence of people being vaccinated for these things, especially, these last year and a half. Unfortunately, a lot of people have let their medical follow-up kind of fall to the side because of concerns of infection and what we've all been going through.
Thank you, Roy, for picking me up. And just one quick note. We may not be being asked the full set of questions we need to be asked when we're donating blood, because there can be other infectious diseases that people have been vaccinated from, not just COVID, that are also very dangerous. Thank you for your time, KD2FIU.
You're welcome. I don't know. Again, it's something that when I have a chance, I'll look up the FDA if it has any policies related to other live virus vaccines. But I thought this might be an interesting opportunity to revisit the concept of vaccinations. Before there were vaccinations, there is an old story. You could Google it. That George Washington, back in the Revolutionary War, decided that too many of his soldiers were coming down with smallpox. So he arranged for the medics to do something called inoculation. At that point, there was no such thing as vaccination. So it was inoculation. What they kind of did was they looked for people suffering from smallpox with as minimal symptoms as possible, and then they would break the eruptions of the pus, the white blood cells, and the smallpox viruses, and they would cut into another person's skin and inoculate them and basically infect them with what they hoped was a weaker version of the smallpox. So that was back in the Revolutionary War. Anyway, that was back in the Revolutionary War. Now, about 20 years later, they figured out that milkmaids apparently weren't getting much in the way of smallpox. And what they looked into was that they would get something that cows had called cowpox, because they were, they kept on milking cows. So they were in contact with the cows when the cows had their cowpox infection. The Latin for cowpox is vaccinia. And so vaccinations come from the idea of vaccinating people with cowpox. instead of attenuated smallpox. So that was the first vaccine. It was probably the last to use that method. Most vaccines up until the last few years have been one of two types. They've either been attenuated vaccines in which you culture a virus to be weaker and weaker and weaker until it doesn't give you much of a bad effect, but it still has the immunological quality to build up your body to resist any further infection from a more virulent form. The other is killed cells entirely. You would denature them. You would put some kind of poison and you would inject the dead viruses into your body. It wasn't as good. It wasn't as good as an actual infection or as an attenuated live virus, but it was relatively easier to do. You cultured up a bunch of viruses, killed it with formaldehyde or some such, and then spun it down and gave it to people. So that was the two types of vaccines up until very recently. Let me drop for a sec. The trouble with these things, well, there's a whole bunch of different troubles. As I mentioned, the killed viruses doesn't give you as good immune protection. The live viruses take a lot of time, and occasionally it can give you some trouble. The difference between the polio vaccines, hopefully most of you remember polio was a terrible disease. FDR suffered from it. A lot of children died because of it. A lot of people were stuck in iron lungs. The original first vaccine was the Salk vaccine. That was a killed virus. Sabin came up with an attenuated live virus. So the problem with that is that I think one out of a million people who are given that would have a spontaneous mutation of the attenuated virus back into the virulent one. So there was a sort of one in a million case of getting actual polio. Thankfully, attenuated viruses are better these days. But they all take time. So they needed something that worked quick, and they came up with the idea of the messenger RNA vaccine that could be, you know, genotyping can be done in a matter of days, engineering the proper proteins and then reverse engineering them and producing massive quantities of messenger RNA, wrapping it up in little protective fat cells and injecting it. As you noticed, they were able to do that in a matter of months. The thing that took most time was the testing to make sure it was safe and the production. And in addition, another new technology, the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca use another attenuated virus, the adenovirus. In that case, they genetically engineer the adenovirus to include the spike protein so that when it affects cells, it promotes the production of the spike proteins using that method. These are two relatively brand new methods of vaccination that thankfully were very effective this time. We got it lucky this time. So I just wanted to remind you people of the history of vaccination.
A2SCP?
Yes.
SCP. Quick question. You said they early on were inoculating people by removing the, I guess it was smallpox, and finding people with small amount of virus, I guess, and then inoculating by giving it to somebody else. What were the results of that? Did it work, or was it a disaster?
Well, as most people could surmise, sometimes it worked. A lot of times it didn't. It was very, very half-assed because you could not guarantee that it was a weaker version of the smallpox. It could have been just a guy with a great immune status. You were never quite sure. So in some cases, it seemed to help. In other cases, it didn't. Again, this was the Revolutionary War. The last thing that they had were research scientists who could sit there and start to calculate the statistics. So they just sort of went with it. It kind of is very reminiscent to me. I don't know if you were familiar with things that were chicken what was it? Chicken pox party. There was a time where if some kid in the community came down with chicken pox before the vaccines were available, mothers would get together and have little parties for their children so that they could get the chicken pox at that age, because you had less complications as a child with chicken pox than as an adult. So it harkens back to the days of inoculation. It was a lot of cleaner and relatively safer than the inoculations. And thankfully, as soon as someone figured out to vaccinate people with cowpox, inoculations, for the most part, were things of the past.
KQSCP, it's amazing what they used to do in the medical field, looking back. I do recall hearing about those smallpox parties, but I never, at my age, stopped doing them. But I do remember everybody on my bus and local area and in the elementary school, everyone had smallpox at the same time. KQSCP.
I think you meant chicken pox. Smallpox pretty much was a thing of the past by the late 70s, 80s. Matter of fact, you can sort of tell the age of people by whether or not they have a smallpox vaccination scar on their upper arm. After, I think, about 1973, those vaccinations were discontinued.
US2S.
Yes, Paul.
You know, years ago, it was a black and white TV show, Leave It to Beaver. And in those days, it was definitely black and white. And you know, most of America would watch these shows. There was only half a dozen different TV shows, really, to watch. It wasn't like today. There was, you know, thousands of different possibilities to watch something. So you had most of America watching this, and they had an episode with what you just said. They had a party. I don't know if it was for measles or for chicken pox or whatever it was. And, you know, the parents would want to send the kid over to somebody else's house to get it over with. Now, all you need is half of America seeing this, and then that probably caught on like the flu. And everybody probably started doing that. I don't know what year it was, but I remember my parents saying, "Oh yeah, you should go to your neighbor's house. He's got the measles or whatever it was." Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I don't know if it was chicken or the egg type of a thing. I know parents were aware, especially of chicken pox. The problem with chicken pox is when you're a kid, it's just a pain in the backside. When you get it as an adult, which unfortunately I got it as an adult, I must have gotten it in the hospital. One sec. You can get neurological problems. You can get sterility. It can settle in your brain or lower down. So it can kind of screw up the quality of your life as an adult, but as a child, not so much. So I think it was so well known generally, and this was, I think, a thing that mothers did a lot. I again don't know if it was brought about by the TV show or it was the TV show that knew about it as well. But it sort of made sense. I never experienced it, so I think I was about 26 or 27. I was a chief medical resident, and all of a sudden I had these eruptions all over the place, and it was obviously chicken pox. Yeah. Nowadays, there's vaccines against it, so no one has to do any of these things, assuming that you're not afraid that vaccines come from alien DNA or people who want to put chips in you.
And that also gives you the shingles, right? I mean, you know, they're pushing the shingle virus nowadays. Talk about, getting a vaccine. You know, they want people to go in for shingles at an older age.
Yeah, it's the same virus, so it's the same vaccine. The vaccine does not have a lifelong effect. So it can wear away, and that's why they're suggesting a booster. Very often what happens in people like me, who had chickenpox, is it settles down, but the virus itself is one of those nasty ones that don't completely die. They just kind of go to sleep in nerve endings. And if your body undergoes some kind of significant physical stress where your immune status is undermined, it can suddenly wake up and start to replicate down the nerve endings. And that's why it usually presents shingles as pain before the eruption is visible, because the pain is reproducing and traveling down the nerve and exciting those pain receptors. And then after a few days, it reaches the skin and blows into these blisters that become very self-evident. So, yeah, it's just recurrent chickenpox, unfortunately.
82FIU, quick comment.
Yes, George.
I wonder what else lurks in the dendrite territory.
Well, another virus that does that is herpes zoster, the cold sore. You get the infection usually early on in your life. It comes, it appears to go, but it doesn't. It sits there quietly, mostly in the nerve fibers of your facial nerves. And again, you have an argument, you have bad colds, that's why they tend to call them cold sores, anything that undermines your immune status, and these little herpes zoster virus particles wake up, replicate down your nerve endings, and give you cold sores in your mouth. So there are other viruses that act like that.
How many, we don't know. And by the way, herpes, 1820, 1830. Anyhow, I'll be quiet, KD2FYU. Thank you, Roy.
Well, you know, medical science doesn't know everything. They just discovered a whole bunch of bacteria that live in people's gut that we weren't quite aware of. So, you know, there's always discoveries to be made, and there might be viruses that travel down nerve endings, but my guess is if there are, they leave far less of a footprint than herpes or shingles does, so which affects your life. You know, especially with shingles, I've known patients that had debilitating pain that was refractory to all kinds of different types of medication. It was a terrible time recovering from it for them. So it's possible that there are other viruses, but they are not that symptomatic. And so, you know, we have billions and billions of foreign organisms living on us every single day. There are more non-human cells in our body than there are human cells on our body. And either they are harmless or they are beneficial. The human gut would not operate the way it's supposed to if you sterilize it. If you've ever taken a large amount of antibiotics to kill some bacterial infection, you no doubt will notice that your GI tract, it took a long time to get around that. To the point where they are even doing what's called fecal transplant in order to inoculate people's own bacterial collection was killed either by another type of infection or by the antibiotic to fight the other infection. So, yeah, it's possible, and that doesn't mean that there won't be new mutations out there that will give us trouble down the road. Life is always evolving. Any other questions or comments on this particular subject out there, please? Okay, does anyone else have any questions or topics of any science-related subject whatsoever? Okay, that was about 98% noise. So if you could either wiggle your antenna in a different direction or kick up the gain, I would appreciate it.
Good evening. My name is Paul from Mount Vernon, New York. November 2, Delta Queen, India.
Hello, Paul. What's your question or subject tonight?
Thank you, sir. Real proud to talk to a doctor. I'd like to know if you could get a replacement COVID card. If a COVID card is lost, can you get a replacement card?
That's an interesting question. I would imagine you could, because I would imagine these records are kept on a statewide basis. If you're located in New York State, I would suggest, contacting the health department if they have any way of getting you a copy.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Have a good evening. 73.
Okay, 73, Paul, and thanks for participating tonight. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Mess. So if you have any technical questions or science-related questions or what have you, and you want to discuss them, we have about 15, 20 minutes before the SpaceNet report. I do have articles for the science talk, but if anyone has any subject that they would like to toss around, this is an opportunity. So we call button, give me your first name and your call sign.
WD2KWC.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, in relationship to the gentleman who asked about the replacement vaccination card, once you get your card, there is an app that you can put on your phone called, I think it's New York State Excelsior Pass, where you put your vaccination information into it from your physical card. So you will have proof of it there. And this is something that's probably, I guess, more difficult to lose than a little piece of cardboard in your wallet.
Please repeat that. What did you say?
Ken said, let me see if I have this. Ken said an Excelsior card, but Ken, did you ever try to do that on your application, on your phone or such?
Yes, I have. It's called a New York State Excelsior Pass wallet, and I think the information you need to provide is your name and the date of the vaccination and the type of vaccination. They will look it up in whatever database they use, and it will be in the app. I have loaded the app on my phone and have put my vaccination data in there.
Okay, yeah, there is an application. They do it so that it's easier. Everyone carries their cell phone around, so this is a certificate that you could flash to anyone or everyone so inclined. You also need some other information, because I tried to do that myself. Unfortunately, someone set up the appointment for me. They used their phone number, so the fact that I did not recall their phone number disallowed me registering. So it won't just take the information like, the dates and such and go with it. They want a couple specifics, which also includes your name, and some bit of identifiers, but definitely include the phone number that you registered your appointments with. And if it all clicks with whatever program it is, it will generate an internal certificate. So you might want to look into that, Paul. Again, the application, I believe, is called Excelsior. I think it works for Androids and for iOS, for iPhones.
Excelsior.
Yes, that's the term. It has to do with the slogan for New York State, and also one of the slogans for the Marvel comics. But I don't think that factored into it too much. So yeah, Excelsior. Just go if either Android or Apple to their store and look up Excelsior. Look up a COVID vaccination, and you'll find Excelsior. So give that a try. That might work for you if you have enough of the information still in memory.
Okay, thank you very much. God bless you.
Likewise. God bless you, Paul. And thank you very much, Ken, to remind me of Excelsior. Probably if I had gotten through, and I still have to ask that friend of mine for the phone number that they use so that I could get an entry on Excelsior. But thank you very much, Ken.
That's what this net is all about, just helping each other. AC2GS, I need to run off to another net, WB2KWC. Have a good evening.
Yes, that's a big part of this hobby, and one of my greatest joys is helping each other. I get to learn something from you people. You hopefully learn a couple things from me. So 73 Ken, once again, thank you so much for participating with us on this technical net.
A2SDP.
Yes, Chris.
Quick suggestion with the vaccination card is just take a picture of it and keep that on your phone. It's not going to get you on an airplane or anything probably, but, you know, get you in the local deli or something that's looking at cards.
Yeah, that's an option. I mean, I just kind of stuck it in my wallet. It's not the smallest thing in the world, but it reasonably fits in there. But yeah, the belts and suspenders, you can take pictures. The problem is, I understand that almost immediately when they came into existence, there were already guys out there making counterfeits.
Well, it can't be very hard. It's just a little piece of paper with some handwriting on it. I was actually dumbfounded at that. Surprised they didn't make it like a license or something. Funny talk. A2SDP.
I think if they wanted to make it really counterfeit resistant, they would have to sit around in a bureaucratic way and think about it for 6 months, and they just didn't have time, so they said, screw it. Theoretically, you can download a blank image. There must be thousands on the internet. You run it into a printer. You get a ballpoint pen and scribble something vaguely reminiscent. And it's not a difficult thing to do, although the money that people apparently were charging on eBay for these things were significant. So it only goes to show how many people are willing to part with their money inappropriately.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
If you look closely at your vaccination card, it is a prescription number that is issued by the states. I can't tell their name, but it is a doctor who has a state title with a specific prescription number against your name, your address, your date of birth, and the precise prescription that it is, each of the one or two vaccinations. That cannot be duplicated. That's a state record. So the card itself is just a representation of this legal vaccination that is on file to your name, and I'm trying to capture, I'm looking at it very closely, but it's extremely individual. It really cannot be duplicated. Maybe in print it can be duplicated. Back to you, Roy, KD2FIU.
Yeah, George, that's the point. It can be duplicated in print. The reason why you can get the Excelsior program to register you with an indicator that you were vaccinated is because there are records in a central location based upon when everyone goes in to be vaccinated, they take the information that they're given, your name, your address, phone number, all these other little things, enters it into a database, and then it scribbles out a piece of paper for you. So you carry the piece of paper. If you show people the scribbled piece of paper, usually they will accept it. They will not go to the trouble of going back to the computer system and the database that's what I think programs like Excelsior does. So although you cannot get a legitimate vaccination record, you can get a facsimile that will fool the average person who accepts people just flashing their vaccine paper at them. So the paper itself is easily counterfeitable. The back server records are not. But a lot of times people don't go to the back servers.
All of this is easily accessible to the person that it was given to with New York State Health Department, phone number, reference number, prescription number, and the individual's ID number. I could see it right on individual ID number. It's huge, but it's on there. So, yeah, the information is available. It is, it's definitely a state record. Back to you, Roy. Thank you. KD2FIU.
Welcome, George. And matter of fact, one of the first suggestions I made to Paul was to contact the health department and that they would probably be able to send him some acceptable version of his vaccination record. And if he remembers enough of the points of reference, he can get approval for an Excelsior proof of vaccination. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways of proving that you've been vaccinated. They thankfully don't keep the records into index cards and shoeboxes anymore. They're all entered on computer displays and backed up regularly. So, yeah, that certainly is true. Okay, so it's 10:09. Let me just remind you people, once again, that if you want to reach me, either to ask a mailbag question, a general technical question, and you're not able to get on to the technical for one reason or the other, or a topic you'd like to hear discussed, like we discussed vaccination today, or a puzzler, like Paul gave me. I love have puzzlers, and I try to kind of build them up so that they even are more interesting for general knowledge and such. So if you have any puzzles that you'd like to share with me for the rest of the gang, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some NASA-related or space-related story that you heard and want to make observations, the email address is mailbag@ac2.com. Again, mailbag@ac2.com. Whole bunch of interesting links are available. There's one very nice link that goes into a light not having any mass. We talked about that a few weeks ago, that light has no standing mass. There's different ways of considering mass, and light has no rest mass, but it does have momentum for a whole bunch of different reasons. So it's a very fascinating topic, and the guy did a very nice YouTube. So that's available, and the link page is roy.ac2g.com. That'll get you to the link page of a lot of interesting articles, YouTube, and some space-related things as well. And remember that I stream the Limarks Glen Oaks repeater. You just point your URL at technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you a stream if you don't have a radio or you're out of the region. And keep in mind always Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. A lot of great wisdom from Dick K2RIW, from Mel K2KEY, and a lot of other great hams who unfortunately have become silent keys, but they shared their expertise with us on the technical net, and those bits and pieces of audio files are still very valuable. So that's at Mike's website, amateurradio.tv. So please check it out. So let's bring on SpaceNet Report, Paul WS2N.
AC2GS WS2N, and thanks for covering that, the vaccine question, and there's so many medical things that come up that if you were to look through the internet, you could spend the better half of your life looking some of this stuff up and still not be sure on some of the stuff that you're reading. What's good about this net is we have Dr. Roy. He can answer these questions for us. And if he can't, he comes back with it the next week, that's for sure. So that's good. Thanks for that, Roy.
You're welcome, Paul. My pleasure.
Okay. As far as the what's new in the space world, the main news, of course, this week is going to be Jeff Bezos and his crew of three going to the Kármán line, you know, over 100 kilometers high, over 62 miles high, in the New Shepard rocket. I'll cover that in a minute because that will take off on Tuesday morning. There was a little weather problem that I wouldn't be surprised if it clears up, but if not, maybe they'll delay it for about an hour. So I'll cover that in a couple of minutes. There's other launches and landings that, you know, I just want to go over. And number one is the Nikkal Russian module that's going to be launched from Kazakhstan on a Proton rocket. Proton rocket is a Russian rocket that's a heavy lift vehicle. They've put all their heavy spacecraft and modules into space with that Proton rocket. It has a half a dozen attached liquid fueled rocket segments that are attached to this thing. So they all fall apart or fall off as it goes up. But you know, you can see the you know, their Proton rocket is one that they've had a lot of problems with over the years. Apparently they've gotten a handle on the problems with it, and they're going to launch this new module to the space station. I've talked about this before. Space station officially, as far as I'm concerned, was pretty much complete years ago, but they keep adding on different pieces. NASA added on an inflatable module called Beam. They keep up the amount of area and the amount of kilowatts that the space station can get, so they send up, you know, more solar panels with crew. The cargo vehicle that Dragon is capable of doing, but Russia still isn't finished. You know, they're going to add this one large module, and it's as big as that first module that they put up, the service module. They call it the Zvezda module, which is their main living area, bathroom, kitchen, crew quarters, and they're going to send up something about the exact same size, around 43 feet long, around 14 feet in diameter. And to do that, they needed to detach an old, smaller module, maybe about 20 foot long, called the Piers. So they'll be doing that this week as well. So anyway, this thing will launch on Wednesday, 21st, and NASA shows it because it's part of the space station, so you can watch it on NASA TV, see if the thing gets off the ground. And then soon after that, they'll show the undocking of the Piers module, which is attached to an older Progress cargo vehicle that the Russians have sent up. Both will burn up over the South Pacific, and the Nikkal will, which is, by the way, means science. That module will be attached in its place. Also has an airlock, and they're not going to lose any capability. Piers had an airlock as well, so they'll be able to do spacewalks from this Nikkal. And it's long been delayed. I think it's 12 years ago they planned on originally sending it up, but it had all kinds of problems. It started with money problems. They couldn't finish it in time. Then they wound up with expiration dates on some of the piping that they had. So that had to all be ripped out, changed. But, you know, it's supposedly up to par now, and see if the space station gets a little bit bigger. If it does, we have a regular crew of 7 people up there. By the way, there was a sighting tonight. I looked at it, I didn't see it. But it's quite large when it goes up ahead. But there's 7 people on board. And on the International Space Station, that might eventually be 8 because of this module going up. Russians usually have no more than 2 Russians on board, and now they might start having 3. But time will tell. And their ultimate goal is to, they're thinking about having their own space station. For now, they're with us on the International Space Station. Us and 20 other countries are involved in this thing. So we'll see what happens in the near future. Let me drop it. Yeah. And then the next port launch, as far as I'm concerned, will be the Starliner. And that will be going up at the end of July, on July 30th. I'll cover that in a minute as well. But now I just wanted to talk about an old-time friend called Hubble. There's a lot of Hubble huggers out there, and they would like to keep this thing going as long as possible. It was launched in 1990 and on Space Shuttle, and they had problems. It's well known for it had vision problems right from the beginning due to the surface of the main mirror was just like a millimeter, or I mean less than a millimeter, the thickness of air, and they needed to correct for that. They couldn't change the mirror, so they changed the optics itself and sent it up a couple of years later on a service repair mission. Things have been working great since, like, 1993, and it's sent back millions of pictures, and probably the most successful scientific piece of equipment that humankind has ever put into space. And since then, there's been 5 service missions, all by the space shuttle. They've gone up and changed everything out from computers to solar panels to different optics, upgrading optics, changing out gyroscopes that control the movement of the Hubble. Everything has been changed out, you know, more than once over the years. But now they have one main problem that they came up with a little over a month ago. And it was a main computer that they use. They call it, it's really called a payload computer. Essentially what it does, it tells all the devices what to do. Tells the Hubble how to aim itself. And it also takes the information that it gets back and sends that telemetry back to mission control. And since that failed, that knocked out the whole Hubble for over a month now. And they've been working on it, trying to figure out, first of all, what was wrong, and then coming up with fixes. And apparently they have come up with a fix, which is great. They put it into operation. Well, they test it on the ground first, of course, see if it works here. And if that's okay, then they upload that information. They have a backup computer, essentially, is what they have on board. And they've really never used it. And sure enough, they went from computer A to computer B. And one thing right after the other, Hubble is now working. So they, in fact, just yesterday, I think they put it in operation to start doing science missions. Good to see Hubble back in working order. I know Bill Nelson's very happy, NASA administrator, because very soon they're going to be launching another space telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope, and that's the one with a mirror 3 times bigger than Hubble. Hubble has a mirror. This thing has a 21-foot diameter mirror. The difference is this is going out 1 million miles away from the Earth, so there'll never be a service mission, not like the 5 missions that went to Hubble, that's for sure. They'll never have one, so everything will have to work. But if it does work, they were hoping to have Hubble and James Webb working at the same time, and right now it looks like that might be the case. They would do you know, take a picture of the same thing with both and compare the two. I'm sure it'll start off that way.
This is Sir Ann Hubble, on the Hubble Space Telescope. Let me drop it, see if there's any questions. Just going back to Starliner, that spacecraft has capability of holding four people. Actually, it was designed for seven, but the normal crew will always be four. The idea is to transport crews to and from the International Space Station on a regular basis. And if there's ever another space station built somewhere, it will also be able to be used for those, for that purpose as well. So NASA years ago, I think 2014, chose two companies to build commercial crew spacecraft to go to the space station. One was the Dragon, being built by SpaceX, which has successfully taken three different crews to the space station so far, and the Starliner being built by Boeing, also Lockheed. But that one has been delayed. There was a friendly competition between the both, which one was going to be able to send the crew first. Naturally, SpaceX is way ahead of them. That's because SpaceX ran their first crew vehicle without a crew to the space station over 3 years ago now. And then that followed up with a crew of two and a crew of four, and now another crew of four. So, and now they have Starliner, was supposed to do the same thing. And after SpaceX had docked with the space station, Starliner launched two Decembers ago. It was December 2019. They launched on an Atlas V rocket. They don't use the Falcon 9 like SpaceX does. So it was launched on the Atlas V, which is built by actually United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed. And sure enough, it got to space. It was supposed to go to the space station and dock autonomously without a crew. Make a long story short, they had computer problems. They had different computers inside the crew vehicle, and it wasn't matching other computers. The crew computer thought it should have been in a different location in space because the time was not set the same as what it was supposed to be, so it kept firing its thrusters trying to get to where it thought it should be in space at that time, and it wound up using up too much fuel, and NASA saw that on the telemetry. They managed to shut everything down, and then they saved the mission by bringing it home. It never made it to the space station, but it did deorbit. It had a heat shield on it, and the idea was to send it to New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico, which it did. It came through the atmosphere with the heat shield, and parachutes opened up, everything was fine. And sure enough, this thing is designed to land on land. Dragon, by SpaceX, lands in the water in either the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic Ocean. Not Starliner. This thing's going to come back. Once it's operational, you'll have a crew inside, usually a crew of four, and they'll come back through the atmosphere, parachutes, and then right before they land, they have these big, I believe it's nitrogen-filled airbags that just inflate these six airbags on the bottom of the vehicle. Once you come through the atmosphere and you have a heat shield, the heat shield separates. You don't need that anymore. Now it exposes the bags, and then once you get right close to land, they inflate and help give the crew a soft landing when it touches down. And that all worked 100%. That was two Decembers ago. At that time, NASA has straightened out all the problems with the proposal. When I say NASA, it was really, Boeing was the main contractor, Lockheed. And they straightened everything out, and now they plan on doing another launch, exactly the same type of launch that they planned Decembers ago. Launch on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41, Florida. Spent a day or two to get to the International Space Station, dock with the Harmony module. They have different modules that can accept the docking vehicles
They're going to attach it to the forward end of Harmony. Going to connect to the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, that they have attached to the pressure mating adapter number two. And if that goes well, sure enough, the crew inside, don't forget the crew seven on board. Get to open up the inner doors, climb through the pressure mating adapter, open up the door on Starliner, and they'll go inside and they'll take pictures of people inside that vehicle. While it's attached to the space station, they did the exact same type of thing with Dragon when that first went up. No crew on board. So now if that stays on attached for a couple of weeks, it will separate from the space station, eventually deorbit, and again land in New Mexico, which has already proven it could do that. And once that happens, there's another identical vehicle being built right now, and that will be the one that will send the next crew up. In this case, by the way, they're going to send a crew of three. When SpaceX first sent their crew up, they just sent a crew of two. One of those fellows, Bob Behnken, was a ham, and the other fellow wasn't. Doug Hurley. But when Starliner goes up, and that will probably be the end of this year, or depending on the scheduling on when Dragon comes back, or, it might be as late as early next year, but right now it's scheduled for the end of the year. You'll have a crew of three. You'll normally have four, but this time your first mission will be a crew of three. Barry Whitmore, he'll be commander, and Michael Fink, who happens to be a ham, KE5AIT, and Nicole Mann, she doesn't have a license, ham license, but at least you'll have one ham going up in that group, just like you did with Dragon. Any questions or comments? WS2M.
Hi, Paul, KD2FIU. I got a question about whether or not they have full responsibility to the United States with the efforts. I know this is not a technical question. They're providing a tremendous amount of technology. They're launching, from what I understand, from the lower 48 U.S. And my question here is that what do they owe the U.S. from this? For example, they're going up to an international space station. What's to say they could turn their back?
Okay, Georgia, when you say they, are you talking about the Dachau mission, setting up the Russian module going up, or are you speaking about the NASA Starliner mission that I was just speaking about? Back to you, Georgia.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul. I was talking about the corporations that were going up for the individual flights.
Oh, good. Yeah, okay. Yeah, naturally, but excuse me, I'm just talking about the NASA Starliner mission by Boeing. Yeah, you're talking about the Blue Origin flight that's going to be taking place this morning, the Tuesday morning, I think around 8 o'clock or so, 8 Eastern Standard Time. And that will be with Jeff Bezos, his brother, and all the women. Wally Funk, she's 82 years old, and now a guy from the Netherlands, only 18 years old, so he's not the oldest and the youngest person ever to actually make it into space, but it's suborbital, and they'll be going up on Tuesday on the Blue Origin Jeff Bezos company rocket called New Shepard. And your question really is, trying to understand the question. What does NASA expect to get out of it? Or is it good for the American society, or is it just good for the company? I'm trying to understand your question, George. KD2FIU, WS2N.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. The A.K. Allen Shepard type flights that are going on, are they full allegiance and ownership to the U.S., or are they leaving this open to any international connections that they could align with?
Yeah, I would kind of like go with B. I mean, it looks like it's all American, but no, the fella that they picked, 18-year-old, his father's got a lot of money, and they come out of the Netherlands, so that's already international. Last billionaire that just went up last Sunday, Richard Branson, he's funded heavily with some. I know Saudi Arabia was part of it, so that makes it international right there. That these are private flights. NASA is a customer. For instance, on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic flight, when he went up on that Unity rocket last Sunday, there was a couple of canisters that they took up with them that NASA wanted to do some research on on a suborbital flight. So NASA will pay them to do that, whatever money they get from that, I don't know. But their main money is going to come from tourism. Both these guys. And they're charging $200,000 or more. Well, that would be for Richard Branson's company, Virgin Galactic. I don't see any price numbers, although years ago I remember it was going to be around the same type of number for flights on New Shepard. And, you know, that, we'll have to see as time goes on. Now, how many rich people are going to lay down $200,000 to $250,000 to do this? When are they going to run out of rich people? I mean, Richard Branson wants to do this like every day if he can. You know, I envision a time when they're going to start running out of rich people. You know, and not every rich person wants to do it. There was one guy, I wish I could think of his name. He was on the, I just read about him. He had plans of going. He bought a ticket for Richard Branson's flight. And the wife basically told him, you know, I'm paraphrasing now. She probably said, you're nuts, you know. You ain't doing this. You got a couple of young kids. You'll leave me alone if this thing blows up. You know, I mean, these guys are millionaires, but, you know, sooner or later, those guys are either going to be told you're not going or they're going to run out of people. And how many people are going to want to do it twice? So, you know, they're not indebted to NASA, although NASA has helped, you know, with all the technology. You know, it's all open source. So I'm sure they're using all of that to develop these things. So back to you, George. I mean, as time goes on, you know, they could start doing orbital flights. They could start putting up their own space stations. Will that benefit humanity? I don't know. I think partially. Back to you, George.
WS2N, KD2FIU. Paul, thank you for giving me a breakdown on where the support is coming from. And thank you for the sidebar from the technology breakdowns that you've been giving us. I was trying to get an idea on where the actual money was coming from, who, what countries. Thank you. You did a great job. I was not aware. Katie, too, FIU, I have some medical problems. KD2FIU.
You just caught what I had over the air. You gotta have a mask on, because I was coughing my brains out before you. When you were talking at one point, I was coughing. So, Yeah, it's interesting. There's other companies that are private companies that are involved in this. There's Firefly and Astra, and these people are going to be sending up rockets, private rockets, which have nothing to do with NASA. So if NASA wants to become a customer and they want to test something, they'll put it on one of their rockets. You know, it'll be a special satellite, that type of thing. For instance, NASA is building the SLS system, baseline system, and I expect the first one to go at the end of this year, unless there's delays, maybe early next year. And ever since the shuttle shut down in 2011, NASA's been working on the space launch system. They took the old engines from the shuttle and refurbished them. The shuttle used to have three engines. This thing's got four engines. Each one's got over 500,000 pounds of thrust. And then they're going to attach that to two solid boosters that they used to, you know, very similar to what they had on the shuttle. You know, each one, one on the port, one on the starboard side, each one had four segments. Well, this one's got similar fuel, it's a solid fuel rocket, but it's got five segments, it's longer. So it'll be able to thrust for a longer period of time, therefore you can actually lift more weight. Here, first mission will go to the moon. They'll orbit the moon and eventually come back, see if that all works successfully. They know the re-entry would work. They've actually tested that in 2014 on the Orion spacecraft. But Orion will eventually carry four people to the moon. And that would be the next flight early in 2023. And they'll do the same thing. They'll orbit the moon, similar to this flight, come back. Right after that, they'll actually try to land on the moon. The NASA's still at it, but they have these independent private companies doing things. You know, NASA puts satellites on their vehicles, just like on the Space Launch System. The first one that goes to the moon this December will carry 13 separate satellites right behind the Orion spacecraft that, you know, that will eventually carry the crew. And behind that, you have the service module, which is built by the European Space ESA, Space Agency. That big, large module, I mean, it's as big as the crew vehicle itself. It's modeled after the ATV, the automatic transit vehicles that they used to send up. When I say they, the European Space Agency will launch it from French Guiana to the International Space Station to supply the crews that were up there. It was a very large vehicle. Sent the most volume and weight up to our space station. They've sent five of them over the years, every couple of years. Sent another one, but they've stopped doing that. They've been replaced by the commercial replacement vehicles, such as Dragon, the uncrewed vehicle. They're cargo vehicles, and Cygnus, which is sent up by Northrop Grumman on the Antares rocket. Or even Progress, and eventually Dream Chaser will be doing the same thing, sending up supplies to the space station. But anyway, the ATV, automatic transit vehicle that European Space Agency used to supply to the space station, it was a successful, very successful system. So they took that part of it, with the thrusters and fuel and everything, and they made that the service module. So they're linked with NASA on the Artemis program. So you know, right up on top, you're gonna have the Orion spacecraft, followed by the service module built by the European Space Station that's modeled after the automatic transit vehicle that used to go to the space station. And then below that, you're gonna have the this adapter piece, which is connects to the space launch system, like I mentioned before, which will have four liquid fuel engines that used to be used for the space station, and will eventually have two large solid booster rack that's attached to it. Well, and right behind that service part of the vehicle, command and the service module built by European Space Agency, right behind that, in this adaptive piece, you're going to have 13 satellites that they're going to fly. This, you know, might as well put something on there, and different satellites will be doing different things. And one of them will be one of the 13 is going to be a solar sail. And solar sail will open up and it will be as big as like a, I don't know, like a best, well, not best, but maybe as big as 100 by 100, let's say. Maybe not. Maybe 50 by 50. I'll have to check the measurements. But it'll be a solar sail that they'll be sending up, which they have a name for it. It's going to be the Near Asteroid Scout vehicle. It's going to be tucked away inside that thing. So here we're going to be paying attention to see if the Space Launch System works. First time that'll ever be launched. Find out if Orion makes it around orbit. But, you know, it'll also be sending out these 13 satellites, and one of them is going to be a solar sail that's going to open up. They said as big as a handball court. I think that's the word that they used, how big that is. And anyway, it'll open up a big, you know, square of aluminum. They say it's as thin as a human hair when it opens up, and it'll catch the photons, or photons anyway, will hit it and repel this thing. You know, it's going to be able to theoretically move it, you know, eventually the speed of light. You know, we'll never get that fast, but, you know, that's the idea, to see if you can propel spacecraft, you know, and use basically free energy. And this one will go to a near-Earth asteroid, and that's the plan. So it'll go out to the asteroid, you know, melt it, catch up to an asteroid, and it'll be taking pictures. It's got a camera on board. You know, we've run some tests. We've had, I think, successful smaller versions of this. This one presently in orbit now, and it stays in orbit, and it doesn't need any fuel. It just stays in orbit. So it's in an area where there are some molecules that will actually slow it down. This thing's not slowing down. So it's, you know, that was a proof of concept flight. This one is also, it's actually going to be a practical one that's going to go out to an asteroid. I'm just curious to see the speed that they can get this thing up to. I mean, it wouldn't be something in the future to have these massive solar panels, solar sails, to be able to push things to the outer solar system. You know, that would really be cool. I mean, after this one gets flown, and they find out it's successful, going to send out another one, which will be even larger. They say around four times larger than that's flying now. Be cool. That I don't know. I had the name somewhere. Anyway, 2023, they'll be doing that. I have no idea what plans they plan on doing with it. You know, the bigger they are, the faster they can go. Very good. Let me just see if anybody has any comments for the net. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Okay, nothing heard. SpaceX, by the way, has made another drone ship, and they had two of these things. Now they have a third one. Gives it these weird names, shortfall of gravitas. Elon Musk reads a lot of these science fiction books and gets these names from those books. Of course, I still love you. And there's another one. Just read the instructions. Anyway, they come from books. Instead of calling it A, B, and C, he's got three of these things now that he lands Falcon 9 rockets on. Gone up to, I just read, 89 successful landings so far of boosters, and I think around 20 of them were on land. That means either it came back to land on Vandenberg Air Force Base, he's got a landing pad out there in California, or landed back in Florida, Cape Canaveral. He's got two big pads built. And then the other 80, the other 60 some odd flights of boosters that landed on these drone ships, comes down vertically. You know, four legs open up right at the last second. One engine lights at the last, you know, 10, 15 seconds. He tends to land. He's in net center. In fact, he's got a big circle and an X in the middle. I guess the X is for SpaceX. He floats these things back. To get them back, you know, he doesn't lay them down out at sea. They're still standing up, and they're hundreds of miles out in the ocean. And he uses tugboats to pull them all the way back to shore. And now he's built this one, new one. And this has the capability of, you know, going on its own. So it could float all the way out to a couple hundred miles out to sea, catch a booster, turn around, and then, you know, use its engines to bring it all the way back to shore. It's going to do that with the other two. The other two needed to be towed. Although this thing, at the very end, as he comes up to shore, the tows grab a hold of it. Very big ship. We're talking about a ship that's about... You know, I mean, the landing pad is the size of a football field. So it's a big vehicle. But now he's got three of these things. He's going to keep two on the East Coast. The other one he sent through the Panama Canal, and he's going to keep that one on the West Coast. He's got a lot of Vandenberg, California launches coming up. That means he probably wants to do a lot of polar missions. Either for the military or definitely for himself. He keeps launching these Starlink satellites. He needs to launch a lot of Starlink satellites in the near polar area. He's got a lot of them in the higher latitudes already. When I say a lot, he's got, you know, coming close to 3,000, I think, of these Starlink satellites. So he's going to leave one landing drone out there, and he's going to have two in Florida. You know, he's quite innovative when it lands. The original ones, he used to send a crew out there to board the ship. Here this thing is sitting in there, and they used to weld these big clamps to the deck around the legs so it wouldn't move. And that's how they would bring it back, you know, without the thing falling over. But since then, you know, he doesn't use a crew to board it. It's kind of dangerous to do that. Well, these things at a deck as they're in position, you know, say one falls over. So he's got this, he calls it the Octagrabber. So the Octagrabber, it's a big, I mean, it looks like a flush contraption that comes out of the work area. You know, he's got this big work area. This big garage door-like thing opens up automatically. And out comes the Octagrabber on these wheels, heavy-duty wheels. And it drives underneath the rocket after it lands, and it's got these big arms and claws that reach up and grab a hold of the tie-down areas that they normally use for launch. It grabs those locations. It's so heavy. This Octagrab thing is so heavy, and it's directly under the booster. Once it grabs a hold of it, that's it. It's not moving. So that's what he does. And that floats all the way back to dry land in that configuration. And after they're done, Octagrabber takes a ride and goes back to his little home. The door opens up and the thing goes back. So now he's built the third one of these things. And each time he improves on it, you know. When he launches the Falcon Heavy, which is three Falcon 9s bolted together, the original core, the one in the middle, had a different grab setup. So the Octagrabber was unable to do that. Now he's reconfigured the Octagrabbers to either grab that one or, well, most of the times the regular boosters that come back. So talk about money being spent on these things. Billionaires over. I mean, this guy's really out of hand. He's building something in Boca Chica, Texas, that's turning into a small town or you know, maybe a small city by the time he's on. In fact, he gave it a name, I think, Starport or something he calls it. So, you know, he's employing a lot of people. And there's a lot of technology that goes on behind this. Tons of people working on all of these different projects, you know. I don't know, it's going to be a different world, I think, 5, 10, 15, imagine 20 years from now. These guys keep going. You've got Jeff Bezos, even so, he's got this suborbital thing he's going on, Tuesday, New Shepard, which is launched like 14 different times. By the way, it's like the 15th flight. You know, he feels it's going to be very safe. You know, they'll go up in this capsule, crew of four in this case, autonomous, no pilot, no commander. They'll take off, fly 100 kilometers high. They'll separate from the boosters. Boosters come down and land vertically on a landing pad. And by the way, this takes place in Van Horn, Texas, southeast Texas. And the booster will land again vertically, using the same BE-3 rocket that they use as a liquid oxygen rocket. It's only one rocket, one booster, and that's it. And that will be reused again over and over again. And so will the spacecraft itself that the crew is in. That separates from the booster, keeps traveling higher and higher. They spend around 4 minutes in weightlessness, going up and coming down. Eventually, they catch the air molecules. By that time, they'll have to be bolted back in their seats, and they'll come back down through the atmosphere. By the way, they only reach around 2,500 miles an hour, I think. That's about it. And they'll come through the atmosphere. Parachutes will open up. Three big blue parachutes, and they'll land in the, it looks like desert, but they'll land in the southeastern part of Texas. They'll have trucks come out, get the crew out, bring them back, and now that spacecraft will be refurbished and fly again for the next group. They'll be able to carry eventually up to 6 people on that vehicle. On the one that Richard Branson flew on, that's 8 people. So 8 people, you have a pilot and a co-pilot, and then you have 6 passengers. And when they went up, there were 4 passengers. They can carry up to 6 paying passengers, and this thing here will be able to carry 6 paying passengers as well when they're done on
that time complete.
A New Shepard. And Jeff Bezos has a plant he's building in Florida. Building another rocket called the New Glenn. You know, you get it. New Shepard was named after Alan Shepard, first suborbital American flight. This new big rocket that he's building in Florida, which should fly in probably a year or so, you know, for the first flight. That's called the New Glenn because that will go into orbit. So John Glenn was the first American to go into orbit. So that's where we got that name from. Built this big, gigantic plant in Florida, and I'll be curious to see when that thing eventually flies. That'll be a liquid methane vehicle, liquid oxygen, 7 large BE-4 engines, they're called. We'll put that thing into space, and that booster will separate, and that will eventually land on a drone ship similar to what Elon Musk does. So Jeff Bezos has his own drone ship that's already built to catch the booster, and the second stage will separate from that, and that also has a liquid methane, liquid oxygen rocket on it. Now that will take New Glenn to orbit. Now, you know, that's a very large vehicle. I mean, if you put it up next to the Saturn V, it's almost as big as the Saturn V, that Neil Armstrong to the moon. Looking at the time, anybody has any comments or questions before I turn it over to Roy? This is WS2N. I have an ID, God knows how long. Name here is Paul, for the space portion of the TechNet. Okay, nothing hard. That's okay. We'll turn it over to you, Roy. And tomorrow's Monday, so we'll try to make it onto the club info net. Doesn't come on at 8 o'clock like this net. That comes on at 8:30 on these repeaters, followed by Flop and Shop. George, you heard him before. KD2FIU does a heck of a job on that, followed by Newsline. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the SpaceNet report and for all that you do for us. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. It was a nice, active net. We had a few people from Echolink, I think three different people who participated. It's a shame that IRLP hasn't been heard. We do have a link up to Barrie, Ontario. Maybe someday they'll talk back to us out there. So hello to people in Canada. Anyway, thanks again to everyone who participated. You guys make or break any kind of a net. No one tunes in to hear me prattle on by myself. So I do appreciate it all. I gave you the link twice already tonight, so I'll spare you that again. I'll once again remind you that Dick K2RIW, who ran this great net for 38-odd years, would often end with something along the lines of advice to be kind to each other. And that's good advice in general. It's great advice these days. Please, be kind to each other. We're getting better. The virus is going away. It's going to have some mini bumps. Please, if you have friends that for one reason or another that's not medical decided not to be vaccinated, urge them to be vaccinated. It's relatively risk-free and very beneficial. So please, be smart, be safe, have fun, and come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we'll try and do this all over again. So this is AC2GS Roy here, formally closing the Limar technical net, and I'll be clear. Be well, guys.
Thanks, Roy, and Paul, K2SDP, 73, guys.
Have a good night, Chris.
Paul, what time is Tuesday's launch, KC1SAM?
Tuesday, well, they said it's going to come on at 8 o'clock. I think it was 8:23 was the planned flight. So we'll see. I know I'm going to hit my recorder. I'll record a couple of stations.
At Eastern time?
Yes, Sam. That's Eastern time. Anytime I look at this, a lot of times it comes up automatically. You look these things up on the Eastern time. But yeah, that's what they said. So I guess it's going to be early for him. Like I said in the beginning, in that the space portion of the net, they're thinking there might be a slight weather delay. So I don't know, if that's true. Usually it's wind. They worry more about wind than anything else. I don't